And here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there across America listening to us and you agree that we have a message that's important, we hope you'd like to come on board as a member of the Radio Liberty family of supporters. It's as simple as calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-544-8927. And for a suggested gift of $20 a month or more, why, you'll get our four best tapes of the month. You'll get our monthly newsletter. But more than that, you'll be helping us to expand our coverage out across America. Now, there are some people who'd rather write. Our address is Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. But we certainly have the foundation of what we do financially and the people who loyally support us month in and month out. And many people give very sacrificially because they think what we're doing is important. I certainly think what we're doing is important. If I didn't, I wouldn't be here 3 hours a month. And, of course, we hope that you will think it's important enough to want to join with us. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention this evening is the fact that we are going to have a Millennium Preparedness Conference, and it'll be held at the Embassy Suites on the Monterey Peninsula on the 24th of July. And if you haven't already signed up, let me encourage you to do that. We certainly would like you to be there. It's going to be from 9 to 5:30. We're going to have Barrett Schoes, who was just with us last night, Holly Swanson, who was with us this afternoon, and we're going to have Dave Wilson, and we have a gentleman I'm hoping will fly out from the East, and he's very anxious to be here. Probably Al Duncan, who wrote the book The Master Plan, will be there. Somebody will be there to talk about water. And, of course, those of you who have wells, who have access to putting in a solar system, he can get you information on that. I've known this young man since he was 4 years old. He grew up with one of my sons, and so I think it's important that you get the information that's necessary. Have you ever wondered what the government officials are planning as far as Y2K? I will tell you what I get from people in Washington, D.C., what they are doing. Did you ever wonder why the mayor of New York has built an underground bunker in New York City for himself and his family and his staff? What are the elite doing? What are the Bilderbergers talking about as far as Y2K is concerned? Are we really getting the truth from the government? What did Senator Bennett really say in his 160-page report? Not what the media has distilled from it, but what did they really say? And, of course, we'd love to have you come. We're going to have to charge for it simply because we have a lot of expenses associated with it. And, of course, this will help Radio Liberty to continue getting the message out. But give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-544-8927, and tell Mary or who's ever working there this evening you want to come to the Radio Liberty Millennium Preparedness Conference. Everybody who comes is going to get a choice of one of the free books we'll have there on the front table and or one of our audio tape sets. Everybody's going to get a copy of my interview with Bob Beamer, who developed the COBOL language. You'll get a syllabus, which will give you the information you're not going to get from Barbara Walters, Dan Rather, or Tom Brokaw. And, of course, I hope a good time will be had by all. That's from 9 to 5:30 on the 24th of July, and we're looking forward to having you with us. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. James Herson, professor of law at Trinity Law School. Dr. Herson, why don't you just pick up where we left off there? And we're in Article 8, pardon me, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And we were talking about the enumerated powers of Congress, the things that it can do, and, of course, all powers not specifically given to the Congress or restricted to it are to be reserved to the states and the people. So would you pick up from where we left off?
Sure. We were talking about the military enumerated power. We just finished the declaration of war power that's exclusive to the Congress. And the Congress also has the power to raise and support armies. But interestingly enough, the Constitution says the appropriation of money to that use shall be, no appropriation, I'm sorry, shall be for a term longer than 2 years. And that's because there was great debate about a standing army. There was concern in the minds of the founding fathers about having too much power at the federal level, and they had great concern about this standing army. This provision has just literally been ignored in modern times. And also to provide and maintain a navy. And I guess the threat of a navy just wasn't as great because it's farther away on the water. And they didn't feel that. And also the founding fathers had just suffered from a standing army from King George. So they knew the presence of an army there. To make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces, and to provide for the calling forth of the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. And the militia, today people refer to that as the National Guard, but at the time of our founding, the militia was us. It was the people who were ready with arms to participate and defend their nation, which we'll get to when we get to the Second Amendment. To provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states, respectively, the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress, and to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may by cession, which cession is the action of transferring title or ownership of something to another owner, of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of the government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be, for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. This was to set up the District of Columbia, which is a federal district and does not belong to any state, and it's located within this federal district, is called Washington, D.C., and the land was originally given to the U.S. government by the state of Maryland, and the U.S. Congress acts as the Congress of Washington, D.C., and the other lands that are owned by the federal government on which forts are located. And then here is another one of these, as Dr. Stan, you called it an elastic section. This is one similar to the Commerce Clause, and I'll read it. This is the last enumerated power, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. And this is called by the courts the Necessary and Proper Clause. And it's another one of these that they'll use and misconstrue, because it says, make all laws which are necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. It doesn't say all laws that are necessary and proper in the opinion of this particular judge, which is what it's been used for. And unfortunately, this has been another one of these clauses that the activist court has said, you know, the founding fathers didn't foresee these new conditions, and therefore we're going to imply a power out of the Necessary and Proper Clause. And again, whenever courts imply, or they say resulting powers or inherent powers, they're getting creative and they're usurping the legislative process. They're making law at that point.
Amen to that. And of course, our real danger is from the people within government who would have an all-powerful government that would regulate and control us from the cradle to the grave, which is the antithesis of what our founding fathers believed. For as you stated earlier, our founding fathers realized that men were basically corruptible, and that's why they created our type of government, where the power of the government was limited by the chains of the Constitution.
Bind them down by the chains of the Constitution, as you said at the opening of the show. Section 9 talks about, it starts off with this language which really related to slave dealers and owners, but right after it, it talks about the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it. habeas corpus is a legal document that orders someone to be brought before a court. So it requires that a detained person come before a court at a stated time and place to decide the legality of his or her detention or imprisonment. And so the right of habeas corpus safeguards someone against illegal detention or imprisonment. Matter of fact, some people make the argument that because it says unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it, that this is an emergency power loophole. But this refers to Congress, not to the president. And so this idea that somehow this provision gives the president emergency powers is bunk. This is not in Article 2, it's in Article 1. And when they talked about rebellion or invasion, they're not talking about de facto rebellion. They're talking about serious rebellion, a war, and that's a different situation. Unfortunately, presidents have used this kind of language as an excuse to create this illicit kind of emergency power action, even going back to Abraham Lincoln, who did have exigent circumstances, of course, to deal with at that time. The next line says, no bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed. And the bill of attainder came up just recently in the impeachment trial when the Democrats wanted to have a censure resolution passed. And it was interesting, the Democratic censure resolution said that the action of the president was unforgivable, that he had disgraced his office, that it was, he used very strong language. And then after he was impeached, they went out on the White House lawn and had a pep rally. But a bill of attainder is a law that's passed against someone that pronounces that person guilty without a trial. And many argued, and I think they were correct, that a censure resolution is in fact a bill of attainder and therefore unconstitutional. And that's why many of even the Republicans that were against impeachment or were too cowardly, were craven cowards, but they still didn't want to have a censure because they felt, in many cases, they were right that this would be unconstitutional.
And then, of course, is the ex post facto law that deals with going back, passing a law today for a crime that was committed last week?
That's right. In other words, we all of a sudden say today that something that you've been doing and taking for granted as being legal, you've been relying on the law as being legal, we say, we pass a law today and say, oh, yeah, you, it wasn't legal, and therefore we're going to arrest you for what you did last week, last year, whatever. And that was because the Founding Fathers had come from a jurisdiction where that had been done. The English Parliament had passed bills like that, but both of these, bills of attainder and ex post facto laws, which is why they put this wisely put this in our Constitution.
Okay.
And then no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. And a capitation is a tax, fee, or charge. And to lay means to impose this burden. And this is what we talked about, this idea of the indirect tax and the direct tax. This idea of making it in proportion essentially made it impractical to have an income tax. And it basically, every person would have to be taxed the same amount and in proportion to the census, which is conducted every 10 years. And so that's why the Supreme Court prohibited an income tax, which came up in the late 19th century. And in 1913, we had this 16th Amendment, a dreaded time in American history, and that opened up the all of us to become tax slaves, which we are today.
But of course, that was sold to the American people. That was really for only the very rich. They were playing the the game of envy. Oh, those terrible rich people, they have so much, they ought to share it with the poor. And this is really not only going to be those people who are making a large sum of money. It's never going to go over 3%. In fact, we're not even going to put in 3%, because if we say 3%, we know it'll automatically go up to 3%. And they sold it to the American people as a lie, knowing full well that eventually this was going to affect every individual. This was actually the second point that Karl Marx had made in the Communist Manifesto, that the road to socialism was through an income tax, and the second item of the 10 items Karl Marx listed in the manifesto was a progressive income tax. But of course they lied to the public, and that's the reason the public went along with it, and why at least many of these states ratified it. There is a serious question as to whether it was ever legally ratified, but I certainly agree with you, that's not the battle that we should be fighting now. That's a battle for somebody else to fight. What we need right now is to get the American people to understand our Constitution, not to waste all their time trying to fight the IRS and its punitive actions against them.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're so right that they used this. History repeats itself. They lied before the 16th Amendment. They lied to get the original income tax legislation passed in the late 1800s, 1894, I believe, and then the Supreme Court, declared it unconstitutional, and then they lied to get the 16th Amendment passed here, and it just squeaked by, which is why there's, all controversy about whether it was passed. No tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state, because the southern states feared that Congress would place an export tax on their agricultural products. That's why that was put in there. And no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another, nor shall vessels bound to or from one state be obligated to enter, clear, or pay duties to another. So Congress wasn't allowed to make laws favoring one state over another. All states would be treated equally. And money can't be taken from the Treasury without having been approved by Congress and signed by the President. In Britain, the King or Parliament would spend money whenever they wanted to and create financial disaster. So it says no money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law and a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. And here is a very important one for today. No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, accept any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state. I think there was a debate in the convention that there were some, it may have been Alexander Hamilton, that wanted to call the president a title like His Royal Highness or something like that. They expressly said no title of nobility, and I think there are some in Washington that would like very much to restore a title of nobility. And no state in Section 10 can enter into a treaty. This is really the same thing we talked about, because before the Constitution, under the Articles of Confederation, the states were acting like little countries. So there's all of the things that basically Congress can do, the states are denied in Section 10. And then we get to Article 2. And Article 2 is the article that deals with the second branch of government, the executive branch, which is, in fact, the president. And the founding fathers did not, I don't think they played hail to the chief at their time. They were very concerned about how strong the president could be. And they wanted, as I said in our first session, they wanted to split power. And so they gave the executive power, it says in Section 1, the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. He shall hold his office during the term of 4 years, and together with the vice president, chosen for the same term, be elected as follows. And there's a long thing about how the Electoral College works, But what is this executive power? Well, as we read further, we'll see that there's an oath that the president takes, and it is to execute faithfully the laws of the land, which is the Constitution and the other laws. And this is what the executive power is supposed to be, meaning that the actions that the president takes are to carry out laws that are already on the books. We unfortunately have a presidential office, and we talked about this when I talked about my book, Government by Decree, where the president has expanded his powers beyond the Constitution through executive orders, through presidential directives, and just through the arrogant exercise of presidential power, where essentially he's creating law on the spot through the stroke of the pen. And this is, in fact, what we call a dictatorship, when one person creates law through the stroke of a pen.
Amen to that.
And now the Electoral College is something, it essentially is a compromise by which the delegates were able to agree on this, on the Constitution. And it came late in the convention. And this Electoral College remains, despite there have been a lot of efforts to try to get rid of it. There's a section, Clause 3 here, was superseded by the 12th Amendment that we'll get to later. But what's important is, technically, legally, these electors are, in fact, free agents. In other words, they don't technically do not have to vote in accordance with the popular vote. They as a convention, as a tradition, they have. But they're constitutionally free to cast ballots for any person they wish.
Now, isn't this all part of the movement to have this a Republican form of government rather than a democracy, and to take the power of government as far as they possibly could away from the people, so they would not, as Plato had remarked in his book, The Republic, vote themselves into a dictatorship?
I think it clearly was, Dr. Stan. And, you know, it was to protect the integrity of the government from mob rule, from a pure democracy, which always ends up in a dictatorship. And because, you know, every dictator practically in history has had a plebiscite, which is a pure democracy, whether real or fixed, where they'll have a referendum, much like these phony polls that we deal with today. And the referendum will say would you like this leader to become president for life? We've seen it in banana republics. And so you're absolutely right. This electoral college concept was set up in order to keep us a more pure republic. And in the system, you know, each state is allocated a number of electors. It's the equivalent of all the representatives and senators combined. And the Electoral College never really meets as a group. The electors from each individual state meet in their own state capitals and cast the votes. And they cast it after the election is already over. And it was changed in 1804, as I said, by the 12th Amendment. But we still have it, unfortunately, I guess, it doesn't function as a protection from a democracy. It's more of a quasi-popular vote now, and the electoral votes from each state just automatically vote for whatever the state popular vote elected.
But now you could have one presidential candidate with a majority of the popular votes, another with the majority of the electoral votes, and the one who had the majority of the electoral votes would win.
I believe that happened with John F. Kennedy. If it wasn't, it was very close. Of course, yeah, sure you can, because
it's
an all or nothing system.
Right.
So if, for example, in the state of California, where we have the most electoral votes, if someone just squeaked by and managed to get California in terms of, you know, only by one vote, theoretically, and then they only 10 votes in New York and some of the more populated states and were a landslide in the rest of the country, you know, that with the opponent, it's very, very possible to have the mathematics work out that you would, that the winner would not get the popular vote.
Right.
Yeah, that is true. But state by state, the electoral votes go to all to the winner. That, and that's why that happens.
Right.
And I think we can, you know, it's a, this section really just describes the mechanics of the electoral college and the electoral system. But I think we can just move on past it. But it does say that the Congress has the power to determine the choosing of the electors and the day they give their votes, and the day is the same throughout the United States. And they were held at different times until 1872, when the Congress set specific dates. And then that was, you know, is affected by the 12th Amendment when we get there. And it does say in this section, defining this one person who's the head of the executive branch, that no person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible to the office of president. Neither shall any person be eligible to that office who has not attained the age of 35 years and been 14 years a resident within the United States. There's been talk at various times about modifying this. At one time, they were talking about doing it so that Henry Kissinger could run for president. It has stayed, and it has to be a natural-born citizen. I suspect in the future this is going to be an object of contention as we, you know, move towards this more politically correct open border approach to America.
You mean before long we'll be electing illegal immigrants to the presidency?
Well, if anyone that walks across the border has the vote, I suppose they could argue that anyone who walks across the border has the election. And then this next section was changed by the 25th Amendment, which talked about the removal of the president from office based on inability to perform or death or resignation. But after that, we see the oath, and the oath of the president is that I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Now, have we really seen our recent presidents carry out this oath, and particularly our current president?
No, we certainly haven't. And of course, that is the great tragedy, is that he is ruling by executive decree, as we said earlier. And, you know, the hour goes by so very, very quickly.
I know.
But I'm really looking forward to our next next get-together when we get into Section 2 of Article 2 of the Constitution. So until then, why, thank you very much for being with us here this evening.
Well, it's my pleasure, Dr. Stan. I look forward to our talk again for this great document. You take care, and God bless you for your work.
And you too. Good night.
Bye-bye.
So we'll be back in just a moment with our next program. And those who are listening to this tape series, which we're putting together, why, of course, the next tape will get into Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution.